Democracy Now.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global news hour. You're listening to KFAI. Please make a pledge of support. It's listener supported. The number to call is 612-375-9030. That's 612-375-9030, or pledge online at kfai.org. It really matters. Thanks so much.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org, non-commercial community-powered radio. Thursday at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio No Show with Don Olson and Dave Gutnick. Well, last week, we presented an interview that the U.S. had lost the Iran war and there was no off-ramp for the U.S. in sight. Since then, Trump's sweet talk invitations to other countries to participate or threats if they don't, seem to have no takers. And the drama was picked up this week when Joe Kent, Trump's pick to be head of the National Counterterrorism Center, announced his resignation, citing his concerns about U.S. justifications for military attacks on Iran. So we're going to play an interview with Lawrence Wilkerson, retired U.S. Colonel, former Chief of Staff in the State Department, on the Democracy Works, hosted by Nima El-Khorshid. This is from Tuesday, March 17th.
With the breaking news about Joe Kent, director of National Counterterrorism Center. He resigned in protest against the imposed war on Iran, and he said that I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it's clear that we started the war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. And we had Donald Trump responding and talking about what has happened and how he feels about, you know, the resignation of Joe Kent. Here is what he said.
Well, and your director of national counterterrorism, Joe Kent, he just resigned today. He said he can't support your conflict with Iran. What's your reaction to that? And
I read his statement. I always thought he was a nice guy, but I always thought he was weak on security, very weak on security. I didn't know him well, but I thought he seemed like a pretty nice guy. But when I read his statement, I realized that it's a good thing that he's out, because he said that Iran was not a threat. Iran was a threat. Every country realized what a threat Iran was. The question is whether or not they wanted to do something about it. And many people, many of the greatest military scholars are saying for years that presidents should have taken out Iran because they wanted a nuclear weapon. They were, if we didn't do the attack, or if I'll go a step further, if I didn't terminate the Iran nuclear deal given to us, one of the worst deals ever made, by Barack Hussein Obama. Remember when they sent Boeing 757s over there, loaded with cash?
Do you have the letter in front of you? Do you have Joe Kent's letter in front of you?
Yeah.
Read the about the third paragraph from the bottom. It's the one about his wife.
Let me just find it here. Yeah, he's talking about his wife was lost in Syria.
Yeah.
And was killed in Syria.
Yeah.
And that's why he hates the war, and that's why he feels this way about the war, these endless wars in the Middle East.
And you got to know Joe Kent before. Joe Kent was really a MAGA staple. He was a MAGA beast. And for him to do this, kind of like Charlie Kirk having his, you know, epiphany about Israel, for him to do this is remarkable because he was an attack dog for MAGA. And that's why they put him in the position they did, and Trump's remarks there were just stupid, just stupid. Everybody knows that Donald Trump and Joe Kent were pretty close. He wouldn't have made him head of the counterterrorism center if they weren't. So this turnaround and that expression of pain caused by the loss of his wife tells me that Joe Kent had gotten, you know, a real epiphany himself about what this war is all about and what Syria was all about, because that's what he's saying, really. And what everything Trump has done with regard to that region, and for that matter, with regard to Ukraine, too, and Venezuela, and potentially Cuba, threatened on Greenland, is Donald Trump. That's Donald Trump. In other words, he's worse than any of the worst Roman, Western Roman Empire Caesars that we seem to think we know so much about, whether it be Caligula or Nero or any of the others that were more or less on the bottom of the heap. Trump is worse. And that's what Joe Kent is saying. Charlie Kirk said it about the connection with Israel. Now Joe Kent has said it about Donald Trump.
Do you expect Tulsi Gabbard doing something?
I would think that we were talking about that this morning. Who's next? It's got to be Tulsi. She simply has to do something to resurrect her future. She's not a stupid woman. She's a smart woman. She's a good politician. She had the right feelings about the JCPOA after much study of it. She knew more about the JCPOA than I did when I walked in to brief her. I stopped the briefing. I brought three experts with me. You know, Trita Parsi. I brought other people with me. And I said, ma'am, Congresswoman, we don't need to waste your time. You know more about it than we do. All we do, all we're going to do is culminate this briefing, get out of your office, and ask you to be with us for it rather than against it. And she said, I will make my decision. I'm still studying. So she needs to resurrect herself. She's got a lot of potential. She's still young. But if she stays with this ship till it goes down, she's finished.
The whole agenda, Larry, is somehow falling apart. It's not just because, you know, when you see Europeans are not that much into getting involved in offensive against Iran, that shows that something going on, and not just in the United States, outside of the United States. Because so far, we cannot say that Europeans were not involved so far. Since day one, they were trying to help the United States defensively, and they tried to defend Israel. But they're not that much, they don't want to be part of this offensive in the Strait of Hormuz. They see that's a red line, as I don't know if we can put it this way. But the whole concept, the whole rhetoric is just falling apart. And you see who's the establishment, who's not the establishment. For example, Mike Johnson today came out and totally defending Donald Trump. And here is what he said, Larry.
Yeah. On the Gang of Eight, I got all the briefings. We all understood there was clearly an imminent threat that Iran was very close to the enrichment of nuclear capability, and they were building missiles at a pace that no one in the region could keep up with. They were far outpacing our allies and friends and us in our defense capability, because we had personnel, installations, members of the armed services, and civilians in the region. Iran was building up ballistic missiles at such a rapid pace, and we knew that their plan was to fire them upon Americans. The commander-in-chief and his administration had a very difficult decision to make. I don't know where Joe Kent is getting his information, but he wasn't in those briefings, clearly, because the Secretary of State, the Secretary of War, and everyone, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, they had exquisite intelligence, and we understood that this was a serious moment for us. Had the president waited, I am personally convinced that we would have mass casualties of Americans, service members and others, and our installations would have been dramatically damaged. And so the president felt that he had to strike first to prevent those mass casualties. That's a summary. I can't tell you the classified part, but that's a summary that's made public and it's accurate. Yes, Manu. Manu.
Let me just tell you what he didn't say. This is what Johnson would have said had he been honest and free with his words. Maybe at the beginning, maybe in the middle, maybe at the end. And we are on God's side. We are on Jesus Christ's side. And we are going to triumph because it is time for Jesus to come back down. It is time for Armageddon. It is time for the end times. That's what Mike Johnson would have said if he didn't think it would be at that point politically bad to say that from the speaker's rostrum, because that's Mike Johnson.
You know what? Otherwise,
it was mostly lies. There wasn't consensus. No question in my mind now, after exploring it more fully, there wasn't consensus. And certainly Cain, if he didn't advise against it, he gave enough information that any commander-in-chief with half a brain would have said, maybe I'm not going here, and picked up the phone and called Bibi Netanyahu and told him to cease and desist because he wouldn't be with him. Because Bibi would not have gone had the president put his foot down and said that to him. Johnson's lying through his teeth. He's lying through his teeth.
You know, he's the way that he's talking, his point of view is one of the main reasons that the people came out and voted for Donald Trump. They thought that Donald Trump would be different, but they see that Donald Trump is the same. And those people like Joe Kent, like Tucker Carlson, they're disgusted.
They're disgusted with their own people, if you will, because they got led down the primrose path by a lot of people making arguments with which they were sympathetic. Hell, I'm sympathetic with some of the arguments. I'm sympathetic with the argument that we don't need to have wars in the Middle East, stupid wars like Iraq and Syria and Libya and Afghanistan and so forth. That was what Trump was saying. And that's what attracted them to him. Go back and look at those comments. And I wish Johnson would have had Bibi Netanyahu up on the right screen while he was saying what he was saying, where Bibi says over and over and over again, for 20 years, Iran is going to have a nuclear weapon in a week or two. Iran is going to have a nuclear weapon next year. Iran is at 90% enrichment. They'll have a nuclear. How many times did Bibi say that? And Johnson was just saying the same thing. This is all manufactured garbage in order to support a president who has absolutely reversed himself on his main tenet with regard to national security. No more stupid wars. Did you listen to me, people? And especially no more stupid wars in the Middle East. That's what he said. Repeatedly. That's why they voted for him. Many of them. That's why they voted. Now he's losing them. He's losing them so fast it's like rats jumping off a sinking ship. And Johnson is going to stay there till the ship goes down. Because Johnson believes it's the end times. He believes God is directing this war.
Larry, what does Donald Trump want from Europeans and from NATO allies when he mentions that they're not helping us? Here is Donald Trump criticizing Europeans.
And all of the NATO allies agreed with us, but they don't want to, you know, despite the fact that we help them so much, we have thousands of soldiers in different countries all over the world, and they don't want to help us. Which is amazing. I mean, amazing. And I didn't do a full court press because I think if I did, they probably would be. But we don't need help. You know, that war has been long prosecuted, as far as I'm concerned. Almost from day one, we knocked out many of these things. We knocked out the Navy essentially in a couple of days.
They don't have a Navy to speak of, so he knocked out a Navy they don't have to speak of. He knocked out an Air Force that was so old it couldn't fly. The only thing they have, Nima, you know, the only thing they have is ballistic missiles, and they have plenty of them. And, you know, Churchill is always quoted as saying everything that ever was said in the world. But Churchill said, the only thing worse than having allies is not having them. Donald, you need to go to school. You need to go to military school. You need to learn what it means to not have allies. And he's losing them, rapidly losing them. And he's losing them because they don't want to do stupid things like he does. And in one case, at least, the Spanish leader, he's losing them because the guy has a sense of ethics and morality. And oh, by the way, did you know two more countries joined the case against Israel in the court? Two more countries. I think before we're through with this, we're going to have anywhere from 30 to 40 countries signing up to South Africa's application to the court for prosecuting Bibi Netanyahu.
So that was Lawrence Wilkerson on Dialogue Works with Nima. Nima is a Iranian national, born in Iran, but he lives now in Brazil. Dave, did you have a few comments?
Yeah, I was disappointed that they didn't actually quote more of Mr. Kent's statement, which is quite powerful, and the most important piece of it was not emphasized there. So I didn't like that excerpt that much, because the key thing about it is he makes explicitly clear that he's disagreeing with the war, and the war is being prosecuted because of relentless pressure from Israel and the Israel lobby. Okay, this is making explicit what lots of many Americans, I would say possibly the majority of Americans, believe is the root cause why we're fighting this war, and that is Israel and its advocates and dual citizens and so on in the United States. So that's a key part of the statement by Mr. Kent when he resigned. And the picture that it's part of is just one more setback to what I call USREAL, the combined US-Israel forces, not supported by very many countries anymore. The Europeans are not stepped up for the Iranian war, despite Trump's request. And I think they're desperate because what's happening, as indicated by the attacks on military bases throughout the Gulf Coast, as well as attacks on Israel, which are mostly suppressed. There's tremendous censorship going on over there, but there's a few things that leak out, and their air defense seems to be mostly gone or inadequate, and so they are being hurt harder than they ever have been. So there's a lack of air defense, which I again believe is contributing to their escalation. So, I mean, to their desperation, and the escalation, it's simply, again, a U.S.-Israel attack in the Gulf Coast. There's no reason to think it would be only Israel, but Israel has a history of trying to provoke and escalate and entice the U.S. to be more involved. So there is that factor as well. So I think there's just an increasing lack of support for what we're doing over there, and Mr. Kent's statement is the latest body blow to the war makers. And I want you to know, just before we close on his story, that as you might expect, which often happens to whistleblowers and people who break out and tell the truth, the FBI has now announced they're going to investigate Mr. Kent. Yeah, they're going to investigate Mr. Kent and be prepared for the smear job on Mr. Kent led by the war faction and the FBI.
Joe Kent has been one of the hardcore MAGA people in the Donald Trump regime, and he has been very well, could be another crack in the wall like Charlie Kirk was. There has been others who have in the conservatives who there's a group of national conservative figures like Megyn Kelly, Tucker Carlson, who have already defected on this issue. And this week, Marjorie Taylor Greene called Joe Kent a patriot. And that so here in Minnesota, there's Tribune had a nice article about some of the differences within the Republican Party here. He said that the war was accelerating a growing rift between the American First movement and Trump's Make America Great Again campaign, which hews more closely to the president. So it's next we're going to be going into a kind of a discussion on U.S. and Israel, who controls whom. And this is on the Gray Zone with John Mearsheimer and Max Blumenthal from the Gray Zone will be discussing him.
So that affects the way the lobby functions in the United States. They're not relying as much on consent or duping people through Hasbara. Liberals no longer support them. I think support for this war on Iran is below 10%, according to a new drop site poll that I saw among Democrats. So it's all, they're just operating through pure force and stealth packs and censorship and control over Donald Trump. And I think that makes it so much more obvious. Yet still, there is a perception that the United States is the dog and Israel is the tail. I mean, that was something that was an argument that was pushed by Walter Russell Mead against you, the conservative historian, when he argued that Americans just love Israel. There's no need for a lobby. Americans just love Israel. But now we can see they no longer love Israel. But, you know, I still hear this sometimes from some more like doctrinaire Marxists on the left, that Israel is just an extension of American empire. It's little more than an unsinkable aircraft carrier for the United States, and that it's the United States that's setting the agenda. What do you say to that argument in 2026 as the U.S. wages war with Israel on Iran?
Well, I would note that my good friend Norman Finkelstein did a podcast the other day that I listened to when I was cooking dinner. And Norman was one of those people who believed I was wrong, or Steve and I were wrong, in 2006 when we said that Israel was one of the main driving forces behind the
war. Yeah, I've argued with him in public about that as well.
Yeah, and but anyway, he was saying, in effect, that we might have been wrong then, but he believes we're not wrong with regard to Iran. And that it's quite clear that that the lobby and Israel itself played a critically important role in getting us into the war that we're now in. It's very important to emphasize, Max, that when you talk about the factors that drove the United States into the Iraq war back in 2003, or you talk about what factors drove us into this war against Iran, it's obvious that there are a variety of factors that mattered. The question is, which factors mattered the most? And if you go back just to the Iraq war, the basic argument that Steve and I made was that if there had not been pressure from the lobby and from Israel itself, and it's very important to emphasize, there was enormous pressure from Israel to attack Iran, and there was enormous pressure from the lobby, especially from the neoconservatives inside and outside of the lobby. Our argument is that the war would not have happened.
Right.
And I believe that that's true. And lots of people, in effect, said that at the time. But, of course, once the war went south, the lobby went to enormous lengths to distance itself and to distance Israel from the causes of the war. And here in 2026, it's going to be much more difficult to do that. Because, again, the lobby is out in the open. What's going on with Israel and the United States is out in the open. And it's so obvious that Israel and the lobby played a key role in pushing us into this war. And Norman Finkelstein was, in effect, saying exactly that about what's happening now. Now, I want to directly address the question that you raise, which is, how do I deal with people who say that Israel does our bidding? This is not the case of the tail wagging the dog. The dog gets the tail to do what it wants, okay? My simple response to that is that if that were true, you would not need a lobby. You would not need this incredibly powerful group of individuals and organizations working overtime to influence American foreign policy. If Israel was such a strategic and moral asset, the government would just axiomatically support Israel, and you wouldn't need a lobby. The reason that you need the lobby is because Israel is a strategic liability, and it is a moral liability. And therefore, the lobby has to work to get the United States to support Israel. It is the tail that wags the dog.
Yeah. Yeah. And address the war on Iran. I mean, I think that's the current context that I think really vindicates your entire thesis. Here's Lindsey Graham.
I go back to South Carolina. I'm asking them to send their sons and daughters over to the Mideast. I go back to South Carolina. I'm asking them to send their sons and daughters over to the Mideast.
I mean, he's been making comment after comment like that. He was trading places with Netanyahu, advising Netanyahu.
I mean, it's amazing, Max. He admits that he was advising Netanyahu on how to convince President Trump to attack Iran. This is truly remarkable. And by the way, Lindsey Graham is certainly a member of the lobby, right? It is important to emphasize that. He's like Mike Huckabee.
Yeah.
He's profoundly committed to defending Israel, and he's profoundly committed to Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he helped Prime Minister Netanyahu bamboozle President Trump into launching this remarkably foolish attack on Iran. You know, if you look at this case, what's really interesting is there's no evidence that anybody inside the administration was pushing for this war, except maybe Kushner and Witkoff, which of course would support our argument, right? But there's no evidence that Vance was pushing for it, that even Rubio was pushing for it. He was too busy worrying about colonizing Latin America to get involved in the decision-making process involving Iran. So there was no pressure from below. And in fact, General Kane warned him that there was no military option. The National Intelligence Council said, in effect, this is not going to work. So there was real resistance coming from inside the administration and no real proponents that I can see. But who were the proponents? Inside the United States, all you had to do is read the Wall Street Journal, which was a cheerleader for the war.
Yeah.
Bret Stephens, who was a cheerleader for the war. Lindsey Graham, who was not only a cheerleader for the war, but was working carefully with Netanyahu, right? And then Netanyahu himself. This man has been deeply committed to getting us involved in a war against Iran for decades. The evidence here is just overwhelming.
Yeah.
But you know what's going to happen, Max? What's going to happen is the war is going to go south, or the war has already gone south, and it will steadily go further south. And what will happen is that the lobby will go to enormous lengths to say that Israel and the lobby here in the United States had nothing to do with causing this war.
Right.
And don't tell me that Donald Trump is not an independent variable who can make up his own decision, make his own decisions, because that's what happened here. Trump's responsible, not Israel, not the lobby. But of course, you and I know better, and the evidence is overwhelming in the other direction. And I think their arguments this time will not convince many people.
Yeah, they'll home in on Trump's demented personality, his claims that he's, which are probably accurate, that he's profiting from high oil prices, his corruption, personalize the entire thing. Oh, maybe according to Rachel Maddow, the UAE in Saudi Arabia made him do it. I don't know. Maybe Russia made him do it. It, you know, it's anything to muddy the waters. But I think at this point, it's just too obvious. You have even Joe Rogan saying, why are we doing this? It seems like Israel dragged us into the war. I mean, it's all just, and actually going back to that drop site poll, a vast majority of Democrats stated that they believe Trump is attending to Netanyahu's interests more than those of the American people, and that this is a war for Israel. Whereas most Republicans just simply don't believe that because they're Trump cultists. Netanyahu made some very revealing comments as well that I think support your thesis in a way that we've never seen before.
Everyone, Judge Andrew.
So that was John Mearsheimer. U.S. and Israel, who controls whom? That was on the Gray Zone with Max Blumenthal. And so they had a discussion there. And what we try and do on this show, Dave and I select different things that, and then talk about aspects of it and how does it continue on. And so this show every week tries to do some things that helps you understand what's going on. And you can pledge today. I've got $500 going. 612-375-9030. And I'd love to have you call and say that you learned some things, have some ideas that you want to have discussed over the air. 612-375-9030 or kfai.org, and you can online pledged as well.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up a couple things. Mention was made of Israel, at least in the realm of narrative control, trying to back off responsibility for the war in Iran. Another example that could have been given is Rachel Maddow recently issued a diatribe against the Arab countries and their responsibility for, or so she thought, for the war, without even mentioning Israel once. You know, they named everybody else in the region, but not Israel, which is really pretty ridiculous. I want to make sure people caught what Mearsheimer has said and others have pointed out, but this is again important in undermining the rationale for war that's being offered to us, because both the Joint Chiefs of Staff head, Mr. Kane, and the National Intelligence Council, which is multiple agencies, warned against this regime change, that they did not have a good military plan and that there was risk of Hormuz Strait being closed. These warnings were ignored. The warnings were made before the war, okay? This is an important point that I want to reiterate. That.
Wait a minute now. Trump said, oh, I could never imagine that.
Yeah, well, he lies all the time. And one more thing I want to follow up with what Wilkerson said, the previous speaker excerpt, because people place some hope. This is part of the problem with this with program, what Don and I are trying to do. We're playing tapes that are 3 or even 4 days old, and this is one of those eras where, as has famously been said, there are decades happening in days. And so, like Tulsi Gabbard, for example, totally missed her opportunity to make a stand and in Congress testified, which I think was tactically kind of smart, but she didn't do any better than this, which was basically to lay it all on Trump's door. You know, she wouldn't say what she herself thought, which has been expressed previously. And again, the intelligence reports were against the plan to the extent there was a plan. It's not evident there was much of a plan because they expected it would all be over in 3 or 4 days, like another Venezuela. So unfortunately, Gabbard disappointed in yesterday's testimony in Congress, where she basically evaded anything except saying it was totally up to Trump. It was Trump's decision, which makes some sense. But, you know, she did not at all take a stand there. There's a lot of work to be done to counteract what has been said. And also, Mearsheimer importantly pointed out, Netanyahu has been on this Iran threat for over 20 years. They're going to have it in a few months, a few weeks, a few days, then it's back to a few months. There's always a constant threat pumped up by Netanyahu and the Zionists on this nuke threat. And yet we had the JCPOA, the Joint Party of Agreement, until 2017, in which there were regular rigorous inspections and there were limits that Iran had agreed to on its enrichment of uranium. And in fact, in the most recent example of U.S. betraying negotiations when using it as a cover for war, Iran, it was reported by multiple sources, had actually offered to go beyond the JCPOA terms in terms of uranium enrichment. So there's a lot of narratives that don't get covered in the official one.
Yes. Right in the middle of the negotiations, Iran said, well, they would put aside a lot of access to the uranium that they had refined, and that it was they made a big jump. And that's exactly when they started the war, when they were making these accommodations. They were going to say, well, this we will do this. I should have made it easier. But instead, they've attacked, and now we're into round after round of weapons going in there. And a couple weeks ago, we already talked about how they're, what's developed into the Iranian idea is to use these low-cost drones to force the countermeasures by the Israel, U.S., and the Gulf states to use these million-dollar missiles. Well, today I heard them, or on the BBC, I think it was, some pushback on the idea that Iran is out foxing, that they're getting by on the cheap. Well, of course, they still have a lot of their really best missiles in reserve.
The fact is, a Shahed drone, their most common drone, costs maybe $40,000 to $50,000. It was seen destroying a $500 million to $1 billion radar installation. Okay, that's a 2,000 or 20,000 to 1 imbalance there. And this is going on all the time. We are actually, this is why I believe they're desperate, because the numbers show, and Larry Johnson has been really great on this at his Sonar 21 site, and there's only so many of our Patriot and important air defense missiles that we have produced over the past few years, and it takes 2 to 3 or 4 or 5 against every incoming missile, and so the arithmetic shows that we are desperately low. One air base, according to Johnson, in the Gulf Coast, one of our bases is already out of air defense missiles. See, so this is what I say is going on. Again, behind the official narrative, their air defense is not holding up.
So we just had word come in that we can thank Kathleen and Spencer for pledges. And don't be shy, you can also call 612-375-9030. It's KFAI Spring Pledge Drive. This is the Northern Sun Radio News, 612-375-9030 or KFAI.org, Pledge Drive.
Hey, Don, I wanted you to get that last tape started, but I'm going to introduce it by reminding people of a historical note so that Wesley Clark famously said in 2008, before he gave way to the Obama candidacy, that in 2001 he worked at the Pentagon and was shown the memo that we were planning 7 wars in 5 years, and this is the Israeli-driven agenda. And we have had wars in all of those, and the last one on the list was Iran. And, you know, we've made up various stories where all these different wars Most of those stories have been false, and a big true driving force has been Israel and the Zionist lobby.
It's
seven wars in 5 years, and we're doing it.
And the media just goes right along with it, and it's we are part of the counter to that here on KFAI, 612-375-9030. Well, that's so this will be next. We're going to have Trita Parsi, who is the vice president of the Quincy Institute. This will be the first time we've had him. He's been on Democracy Now! A lot. Usually we have different people than Democracy Now! But last week they had Lawrence Wilkerson. A week ago Tuesday, boy, was he ever good. And so it's, we all try and do our bit. And here, this was to the topic, why do the U.S. and Israel hate Iran? This will be on Judging Freedom with Judge Napolitano.
Quincy Institute, I should say.
Now here for Judging Freedom. Today is Monday, March 16th, 2026. Our guest is Trita Parsi. Trita is a world-renowned expert on Iran, is the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, an organization that many of you know I've admired for many years. Trita, welcome here. I know you're very much in demand, and we're very privileged to have you here.
So I had to flip the tape over. So it would be just...
Thank you. Can you explain the unrelenting hatred that the Israeli governments and the American governments have had for Iran for 50 years?
So, you know, the roots of those sentiments are quite different. I think it's very important to recognize that the Israelis actually did everything they could back in the 1980s to get the United States and Iran back on talking terms and actually helping the Iranians. The U.S., of course, had its fallout with Iranians because of the hostage crisis. The Iranians were very upset because of the 1953 coup, and which then, you know, obviously backfired on the U.S. by the time you had the revolution. But from the Israeli standpoint, they were adamant about making sure that despite this very significant change of regime in Iran, that they would still be able to count on Iran as a geostrategic ally. Iran had played a critical role for Israel's security since the early 1950s, when Ben-Gurion's doctrine of the periphery was put in place, the idea that Israel's security will be achieved by creating alliances with the non-Arab states in the periphery of the Middle East in order to balance the Arab states in Israel's vicinity. No periphery power was more important than Iran, not just because of its size, its military, but most importantly also because of its oil reserves, which at one point covered up to 80% of Israel's needs. So when the revolution happens and this new regime comes into place that is very anti-Israeli, at least on the surface, the Israelis immediately reached out and tried to convince the Iranians that despite their ideological opposition to Israel, they would be faced with the geopolitical reality that necessitated some collaboration. And that's part of the reason why you had the Iran-Contra scandal, in which the Israelis were pushing the U.S. to sell arms to the Iranians out of a fear that if Iran lost the war against Saddam Hussein, Iraq would become a very powerful state and would be very, very bad for Israel geopolitically. So this hatred that we're seeing is really rooted in the changes that happened in the region in 1991 to 1993. That's when the two key factors that actually pushed Israel and Iran closer together, the common threat from the Soviet Union and the common threat from strong Arab nationalist countries such as Egypt under Nasser or Iraq under Saddam Hussein, were all gone. And a completely new geopolitical reality emerged in the region, in which Iran and Israel actually emerged as two of the more powerful states. And now suddenly these Israelis started to fear that the United States, 10 years after the revolution, would move towards a warm-up with Iran, which would then potentially reduce Israel's strategic significance to the United States. This was already a shock because of the fall of the Soviet Empire meant that the Cold War was over, and this, Israelis played a key role for the U.S. in the Cold War as an outpost of Western friendliness in a region that otherwise saw the Soviets make a lot of headway. But without the Soviet Union, what was the need for Israel? So this is the moment you suddenly see the Israelis really turning against Iran, pushing the U.S. to sanction Iran, push, you know, this constant talk that Iran is 2 years away from a nuclear weapon. This is what we started to hear back in 1994, 95. Time passes, but they're always 2 years away from a nuclear weapon. That all started with the Israelis back then because they were trying to do something to make sure that Iran rose on the list of geostrategic threats from the American perspective. And they were quite successful because we had decades in which the American politicians constantly kept on saying that Iran is the greatest national security threat to the United States, which was laughable on its face, but it was the politically convenient thing to say.
Laughable on its face because Iran never threatened the United States and had no ability to harm the United States.
A hostile state in many different ways. There were clearly efforts by some within the Iranian system to reach out to the U.S. and try to find a new balance. But at the end of the day, with zero capability to threaten the American homeland in any serious way. Even now, if you take a look at what's happening in the war, the Iranians do have significant capabilities to strike at these bases in the Persian Gulf. But the U.S. Navy is keeping itself 3,000 kilometers away from Iranian shorelines and as a result cannot be reached by the Iranians. Well, if the ships can be that far away and be safe, the United States is thousands more kilometers away from Iran.
Correct.
The legitimate threat picture in terms of the Iranians threatening the American homeland. There was a
Is there any basis for the ubiquitous claim by the American neocons that Iran is the world's greatest sponsor of terrorism? And I would argue that Israel is the world's greatest sponsor of terrorism, but we won't make the comparison. Is there any basis for that argument condemning Iran as a progenitor of terrorism?
I think for the last 20 or plus years, that statement really can only be taken seriously if we fundamentally change the definition of terrorism. So, you know, essentially, if Iran is supporting groups that the United States doesn't like, and as a result, we call that terrorism, then yes, they're one of the biggest sponsors of terrorism. If Iran is the country that is fueling terrorist acts in Europe, in the United States, behind the 9/11 and things of that nature, then absolutely not. In fact, we've seen far more support for that type of a Sunni jihadism coming out of some of the GCC states, particularly Saudi Arabia, state-sponsored, rather than coming out of Iran. But, you know, to be frank with you, the U.S.'s list of terrorist organizations is at this point really laughable because we take groups off willy-nilly based on whether we like them politically or not, not whether they've actually are engaged in or continue to be engaged in terrorism. One of those groups, for instance, is the Iranian Mujahideen that was on the terrorist list for a long time because it didn't disavow violence. It was involved in a lot of terrorist attacks. It killed a lot of Americans. But because of a massive lobbying campaign under the Obama administration, the Clinton State Department took them off the list, and they had a lot of support both from Republicans and Democrats to do so. But a year later or 2 years later, we found out that the Israelis were using that very same group to conduct terrorist attacks inside of Iran.
Oh, boy. Well, and, of course, we have the infamous case of the so-called president of Syria, who on day one had a $10 million bounty on his head for cutting people's heads off, and on day two was dressed in a Brooks Brothers suit and on his way to the Oval Office. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. All right.
And you also saw, you know, the Sudanese got off of the State Department's terrorist list by simply agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. Nothing else.
Right.
So, I mean, it's, you know, it's undermining our own credibility. That list at this point is just seen as completely political.
Do the Iranian people generally support the structures of government in Iran, the supreme leader, the council of elders, a revolutionary guard, an elected president, an elected parliament?
I do not believe that a majority do. I think the support base of the current theocracy is probably between 15 and 20%. But that still means up to 18 million people, and they're very, very dedicated supporters. Incidentally, they have been dramatically energized by this war. Frankly, we've not seen them as energized now compared to at least 10, 20 years. I think there is another segment of the society that is against the regime in a way that they're almost willing to go get rid of the regime at any cost. I don't think that percentage is very, very high, but it is common amongst the younger generation who look back at the last 25 or so years. They see that the reform agenda did not generate the type of a change at all that they expected. In many ways, frankly, Iran is more closed politically today than it was 25 years ago. But then you have a very significant group of people in the middle who are not supporters of the regime, but they're not going to support any change in the regime at any cost. For instance, at the cost of a foreign invader or a foreign country bombing their country. And as long as that group remains a very solid majority, it means that the combination of the two enables the theocracy to live on as long as there's a bit of a promise that there can be some sort of a change coming from within. The more that promise has become hollow, the more you see that people have been pushed in more radical directions of wanting to get rid of any type of things. And that's a process we've seen in the last couple of years.
We all know.
So we want to thank Susu, who has also pledged. You can too. 612-375-9030. We try and present a lot of information that helps you understand what's going on in the world. Dave, do you have any comment?
Just want to remind people of the momentous turn of events. Just again, week after week, now we have a serious escalation of the war, with attacks on the world's, possibly the world's biggest gas fields, both in Qatar and under the maritime border in Iran. And Iran is not too interested in negotiations anymore after having been betrayed twice during negotiations, which the U.S. used to surprise them or attempt to surprise them and launch serious attacks. So Iran, in turn, is attacking our U.S. bases, which has been there ever since we made the deal with the Saudis in the 70s to provide them military protection, quote-unquote, in exchange for trading the petroleum in dollars, which have been an absolute keystone to our financial empire around the world. So Iran is going to demand, or is demanding, the U.S. bases leave. They're putting the pressure on the Arab Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC countries, to stop this dependence on the U.S. And so that's just an indication of the major things that's at stake here. And as for Israel, again, I believe they're desperate and have never been attacked to the extent they are now. And the underlying question that should be brought up, and if we want a real resolution to the things in the region, Israel has to subject its nuclear power, its nuclear arms, to international inspection, just like every other nuclear power should be.
Yes. And as Democracy Now! Is the only one that points out, everything, all the news media which are in Israel, they're all subject to censorship. So nothing gets out that they don't want it to
be. Yeah, you can actually be given, I think it's 5 months or up to 5 years in behind bars in Israel if you release video showing the attacks that are being made every day. So the censorship doesn't exist to that degree in Iran, despite the propaganda. Iran invited CNN to come in and report on the war.
CNN has been doing some things which the Trump administration is so wanting to have the CNN brought under right-wing political control.
Just like TikTok was showing too many atrocious videos from Israeli atrocities, and so they needed to have that bought out by another Zionist, Larry Ellison, so there would be more control of what was shown to the public.
Yes, and it's Larry Ellison's son with money from his dad, Larry Ellison. Right. I had an interesting little thing I took from the columnist John Rash from the Star Tribune. I picked it out of his, yes, from yesterday. In its effort to sell, if not celebrate, military success in Iran, the Trump administration has produced its own video series. The work doesn't offer geopolitical justification for the conflict, appreciation for the sacrifice of U.S. troops abroad, or calls for commencement action on the home front, but instead intersperses footage from military strikes with clips from movies, TV, and video games. Viewers see seamless shifting from real explosions to pop culture touchstones like Braveheart, Top Gun, Iron Man, as well as video games ranging from Grand Theft Auto, Call of Duty, and even something which I don't know about, Wii Sports. And the White House isn't defensive but defiant over this image. When CNN ran a story about it, White House Communications Director Stephen Chin took to X to thank the network for, quote, covering all of our banger videos. Bang, bang, boom, boom, shoot, shoot.
This is the adolescent mentality of our leadership really inspires confidence.
It's hardly the way to have a... foreign policy as a way of any kind of a policy. The I want to tell you about the WHAM. Well, before I do tell you that, we want to thank Susu for her pledge. And you can pledge too at 612-375-9030 or kfei.org pledge. So with the WHAM 2026 annual meeting is a week from this Saturday, March 28th, resisting ICE occupation and fighting to end domestic militarism. Speakers Medea Benjamin of National Code Pink and local Minneapolis leaders involved in protesting ICE and demanding justice for stolen lives. It'll be at the New City Center. It's the old Walker Church, birthplace of KFAI, 31st and 16th Avenue South of Minneapolis. And it's a 9:30 a.m. light brunch program at 10 a.m. It's a free event, but a suggested donation sliding scale to ensure WHAM continues work for peace.
The surge isn't over. There's still several hundred ICE agents in Minnesota.
So this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson, along with Dave Gudnick. And next up, it'll be Global Beat.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
August 1998. It was one of the worst days of Monica Lewinsky's life. 3 years ago, the Beverly Hills 20-something had nabbed a coveted internship at the White House. And 4 months later began what would become a sporadic 3-year affair with none other than the nation's chief executive, President Bill Clinton. It was a private affair that in January of this year had blown up into a very messy public scandal. The president was facing impeachment for lying under oath about the affair, among other things. And today, Lewinsky was being compelled to testify before a grand jury about her involvement with Clinton. A recitation that included a little name-dropping. Lewinsky suggested that Eleanor Mondale, TV personality and daughter of former vice president and Minnesota senator Walter Mondale, had also been carrying on with the Prez. Rumors had surfaced about this before, but now it was part of public record. Clinton would ultimately be acquitted by the Senate, but Lewinsky and Mondale would continue to be haunted by their association with the president.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities.